Welcome, everybody, to the Sun on the Strip podcast. I'm your host. I'm Brock Radke, the entertainment writer for the Las Vegas Sun, and I do this podcast every Wednesday in order to keep you posted on everything that's going on in entertainment from the world-famous Las Vegas Strip. Thanks for listening. In the news this week, the Planet Hollywood Resort and Casino is finally reopening on Thursday, October 8th. Planet Hollywood, of course, has been shuttered since mid-March. Interestingly enough, the Miracle Mile Shops has been open since early June, continuing to operate even though the casino that it is attached to has been closed. I wrote a story about that, and you can read that story about the Miracle Mile Shops and the very popular Raider Image store that has opened within it at LasVegasSun.com. Once Planet Hollywood is open, that will mean there are only two Caesars Entertainment-operated casino resorts still closed in Las Vegas. Those are the Cromwell, which has been rumored to be reopening soon as well, but we'll have to wait and see, and then the Rio, which is just off the Strip on Flamingo Road. One of the shows that had been performed at Planet Hollywood in the Miracle Mile Shops, Aussie Heat, has become the first male review production show to return to the Strip. Aussie Heat was back in action over the weekend at the Mosaic Theater, the independent venue on Las Vegas Boulevard. It used to be where Empire Ballroom and Club Utopia, it's that space towards MGM Grand. Aussie Heat is just one piece of the live entertainment scene that has reactivated at the Mosaic Theater. I'm going to be writing about that as well as giving you the full update on when shows might return to the Las Vegas Strip, major shows, in my column this Thursday and every Thursday at the Las Vegas Sun website. My column is called Curtain Up, and you should be reading it every Thursday morning at LasVegasSun.com. And even more show news, Morrissey's short-term five-night residency that was originally planned for earlier this year has been rescheduled, has been postponed, and now tickets are on sale for these new shows. Morrissey Viva Mas Vegas at the Coliseum at Caesars Palace is now going to be happening for five nights in the summer of 2021. Those dates are August 28th and 29th and September 2nd, 4th, and 5th, 2021. Morrissey. You can go get your tickets at Ticketmaster.com/MorrisseyVegas. A very in-depth interview this week on the Sun on the Strip, David Sachs. This guy is Vegas royalty. His mother was a showgirl and dancer. His dad was a band leader that worked with the Rat Pack and many of the headliners of the 60s and 70s in various casinos in Las Vegas. His sister is Melinda, the First Lady of Magic. And David Sachs is a born and raised Las Vegas native who has been absolutely intertwined with the entertainment scene from the time when he was a little kid setting up for shows, for his dad's shows. He is a producer and he is a theater owner and operator. He runs the two theaters in the aforementioned Miracle Mile Shops at the Planet Hollywood Resort. The V Theater and the Sachs Theater are home to such popular long-running shows as V, the Ultimate Variety Show, Vegas the Show, Zombie Burlesque, and many, many more, some of which Sachs produces himself and created himself. Other are third-party shows that he has provided a home for and really kind of nurtured to success. In fact, I'm going to say that between those two venues, this Sachs Productions empire is overseeing the highest number of shows out of any company operating in Las Vegas these days. So I finally got the chance to check in with David and talk about his history and his career and really the new way that he set up producing shows in Las Vegas, but also what's going on right now and how he's kind of sorting through the new rules and protocols and safety standards that shows have been given to work with in order to reopen. I think if you've been waiting to see when shows are going to reopen, this is going to be we're going to pull back the curtain, and David is going to talk about exactly how difficult these challenges are in order to get his shows up and running once again. So check this out. Shut off your phone. Stop doing what you're doing. Pay attention to this really cool conversation with David Sachs.
I think there are very few influential people in the showbiz scene who are, you know, born and raised natives and really grew up in Las Vegas the way that you did. Maybe we can start by talking a little bit about your parents and their careers and, yeah, how you really did just grow up in this scene.
I think it started with, obviously, my mom and dad. My dad was band leader for a lot of the shows in town. He had a release band, which some of the shows were 7 days a week. So he would perform, or he put like an all-star band together that would perform on the night off for Folies Bergère or Lido di Paris, a lot of these production shows. And they were good enough to catch up in one day, you know, what the house band was doing 6 days a week. And that kind of evolved to, he started doing corporates when they started back in the 60s. And he was putting together music and the bands for corporate stuff. And then they would ask for more entertainers and more entertainment things, you know, specialty acts and dancers and other stuff. And he had met my mom in Follies. She was a dancer in Follies Bergère. They got married, had me. And these conventions that they put together, my mom would start doing the dancers and the choreography and putting all that together, and my dad would do the band mostly. And then my two sisters, who they were dancers and shows in Vegas. Well, before then, they were in like junior high school, and they would be in these corporates dancing. You know, my mom would choreograph them dancing, and they get their friends. And it was just very much our gang, Little Rascals, let's put a show together kind of stuff for these corporates, and just started getting good at it. I was just a schlepper who put the music stands up, and so I was just a little kid. So I would like help my dad set up and just do all the technical stuff, and they just got better and better at it. And then my sister Melinda wanted to have her own show. She was in Siegfried and Roy's show at the time as a dancer, and she's like, I could do this. I could do what these guys are doing. Plus, I could dance. I'll be the only girl doing it. So we kind of, the whole family, we just put a little show around her at Bourbon Street Hotel in 1986, I think. Maybe 1987, I can't remember. And, 1986. I was in high school, and so I was doing two shows a night, and going to school, not getting home till like 2 a.m. It was pretty hard, but I was the maitre d'. I ran lights, sound. I was still a stagehand. I remote controlled the curtains and pyro and all kinds of stuff. I had all these gadgets going. And I just learned the business through being in the back of the house, you know, watching the show every night and running the show, seeing what audiences liked and didn't like. And it's just, I tell all the techs too that work for me, I said, you know, you're in the most important position here. If you're running lights or sound, you actually can see every night what works, what doesn't work, and timing of things, and how adding a light or sweeping lights at the end, you know, and how to crescendo things at the end, give it a, you can sort of control the audience and make them applaud, and you have full control over this stuff. It's amazing what you learn by just seeing so many shows, you know, every single night, night after night. So there I am in high school, just running the shows every night, and I'm figuring out what audiences like. Because I ran lights and sound, I could do sound effects and start throwing in creative things. And I started working, you know, I'd give my sister pointers, and then the acts in the shows, I'd start helping them write and come up with funnier ideas. And it just evolved. I started falling in love with it because when you're just there every night, you just, it starts becoming really clear what works and what doesn't. And I couldn't wait to write and change things in the show and to see if it worked. And it started working, and you just get hooked once you kind of come up with an idea and you put it in the show and it works and the crowd goes crazy. It's addicting. You want to try more and write more and put more stuff in. So that's a condensed version of sort of how I got into showbiz and fell in love with it.
Your sister obviously and famously went the onstage route, and I think is one of the most iconic performers. You know, everybody knows Melinda's name. Did you ever, when you were younger, did you ever have any ambition to perform in any way or be some kind of performer, or have you always just been comfortable behind the scenes?
It's one of those things where I do not want to be a performer, and I have stage fright, and I just don't want to do it that way. But through, you know, I like writing and directing and showing them how to do it. The people I direct or even my family and my mom and sister, and then they become the funniest guy on the planet. And they always say, you got to go on stage. You got to do that on stage. You know, I'd imitate tap dancers who are horrible and just do, I was just a goofy kid and class clown. And they all tried to encourage me to do it. And I'm like, no. I just don't want to do it. And I didn't like, wasn't that I was scared, but I secretly really wanted to be on stage. I didn't. I really didn't. I loved all of that, but I didn't want the attention for some weird reason.
What about musically? Do you play any instruments, or did you when you were younger follow?
Yeah.
Footsteps?
I played when I was little. Well, in junior high, I started playing trumpet, and I got really good. That's when the whole musicians union strike happened, and it was you know, all the live bands everywhere. They signed some deal where they didn't have live music anymore, and they could just play everything on tape. So it was right at that time, and my dad was just so distraught about all the, you know, no outlook for live musicians. And he just looked me in the eye. He's like, don't be a musician. Stop it. He could tell I wanted to be him. And I was practicing 6 hours a day. My lips were just swollen constantly from just playing and wanting to be great. And he was really good. So I guess I was trying to be, but now he said, don't do it. You know, own the shows and go the other route, but just don't be a musician. There's no money in it. And he was really pissed. But I remember thinking, one day I'm going to have shows. I'm going to put live musicians back in it. Because back then we just didn't think there'd be live musicians and shows again.
Yeah, and you did do that when you go see, before all of what's happening today, of course, when you would go see Zombie Burlesque or Vegas the Show, these are shows that are, you know, smaller than a lot of shows on the Strip, and you still have full bands in those shows.
Yeah.
And I think that takes people by surprise, but it also really adds an exciting element to those shows. Doesn't matter what size it is. When you've got the live band, that really...
No, I love it. Listen,
at another level, right?
The band leader for Vegas the Show, Pat Caddick, he and Jerry Lopez, they're co-band leaders. And when I put that show together and I hired them and the whole orchestra and stuff, and they kept saying, all right, so when you fire us all and just use the tracks, you know, please give us enough notice. And I go, what are you talking about? So they just kept talking like, well, we've penciled it in. It doesn't make any financial sense, and we're sure you're going to get rid of the band. So when you do, just make sure you give us enough notice. I'm like, will you guys quit being negative? But, you know, I'm telling you, I wouldn't do that. And it was just funny how they just automatically know they get abused and just to open a show, and then they're just going to go to tracks or something. And I'm like, I promise you, I love live orchestra. I want to keep it as long as I can. So we did 10 years of till COVID. We're going to give a lot of musicians jobs, and we're 7 days a week and rotated a lot of musicians. Same with, Zombies 6 days a week, but we had hundreds of musicians playing in those shows over the last 10 years. So I'm happy about that. Yeah,
those shows had really become, I mean, on and off throughout the years, obviously live music gets cut out of different shows of different sizes, and at times it has seemed like there just isn't very much live music left in those kind of shows on the Strip. It must be a struggle to maintain those expensive
It's expensive, but you know, the most expensive thing by far is labor. You know, the more people you add, it's just, then you got insurance and it just gets pricey. But I can't imagine it without it. Unfortunately, I think with COVID and nobody coming to Vegas, or very few people coming right now, and if we can only open with 20 people in the audience, there's just absolutely no way we can have a live band. So if we reopen these shows, I think we would have to reopen them without a live band, which I just don't even want to do. But that might not have a choice.
Now, you've been running many shows across the different rooms that you operate at Planet Hollywood and the Miracle Mile Shops, the V Theater, which came first, I believe, and then you eventually took over the space that you made, the Saks Theater. How did this whole development come about? Because I'm assuming it wasn't your plan to take over these spaces and fill them up with as many shows as you can. And it's been such a wide range of entertainment that you've been putting into those places. So how did this all happen?
Yeah, you're right. My goal in life wasn't to become a landlord, so to speak, and have different shows inside of my play. I have a ton of different shows from third-party producers. I'm a show producer. I have a show. I had the Ultimate Variety Show at the Venetian, and then that showroom, they announced they were going to tear it down and rebuild, I guess, Blue Man Group. They'd done a deal with Blue Man Group to go in there and rebuild for them. So I was faced. I had no other place to go. And the show was very successful. I'm doing great. And every showroom in town was packed. And with the Cirque show, and I couldn't find a primetime spot at any of them. So I took the space where the theater was. It used to be the food court for the Miracle Mile Show, or for the Deserted Passage in the bankrupt Aladdin Hotel. It's called the Deserted Passage, the Desert Passage. And it was converted then for a restaurant or something, and that failed. And nothing had worked in there. And I really had no other option. So I said, screw it. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to make this thing work, and pay huge rent, and inside of a mall, no hotel support. And everybody in the industry called me and said, I'm nuts. What the hell am I doing putting a show inside of a mall? I said, I don't care where you put me. This show's too good, and I know how to market, and I'm going to bring them here. So we did that and made it work. But, still a struggle, such high rents and such. So it was, man, I got to put more shows in here just to help pay for this rent. So I started putting third-party shows in as well. It couldn't all be mine, and shows that I believe in. And I remember when you have a show and a property doesn't promote you or help you at all, and they act more like a landlord, you know, that I know what it feels like. So I vowed to never do that to any shows that would be in my properties. I'm going to treat them like they're my shows and treat them great. And so I did that and helped the shows as if they were my own, and made them successful too, because I didn't want anything to not succeed. And it just kind of grew out of that. Then I started becoming a theater owner, and like, wow, I got to think like a theater guy. I got to wear two different hats. The show producer thing I got down, but this theater owner thing, I'm going to do it the way I always wanted to do it. When we used to criticize the casinos in the old days, like, why did they do this? And why are the ushers, why don't they have any personality? And why are they rude at the box office? And I go, that's it. We can control all of this now. So we're going to make it fun. And it's a lot harder than you think. You try and get actors and creative performers to be ushers and stuff. And it's a little tougher than you think, but at least we do it differently. than a lot of the theaters do, and we can control all that. So it's kind of fun. It became something I liked to do, and running actual theater. And then the other theater, Stax Theater, came about because we had Steve Wyrick, this magician. He had somehow convinced the mall to allow him to put a theater in there. So now we're successful. So now I got to compete against another theater inside the mall. He built out, you know, really beautiful theater and spent a lot of money on it. And unfortunately for him, he went bankrupt and couldn't make it work. So we took it over. The mall asked us to take it over because we're successful operators of a theater. So we took that over. And then I said, oh man, this doesn't make financial sense unless I have a blockbuster hit in there that we own so we can pay the rent. And so that's when I created Vegas the Show. And luckily it all worked out and it hit and made that theater a success. And then I put a couple other shows in there as well.
It must also be challenging because you can't, obviously you can't have the same kind of show over and over. You have to have, you know, like Popovich is obviously a family friendly show in the afternoon. And then you've right. got like the Motown show, I know has been pretty steady over the years. You've got the Magic, yep. you've got the Mentalist.
You're really trying not to have any crossover. So a lot of the stuff I did hadn't been done before. So the traditional thought would be, oh, we're just going to compete against ourselves. That's too many shows going after the same customers. And those things, which seems logical, but you know, we just did it and we found that actually, no, it just creates more awareness. You know, once when somebody comes to, especially because we control the box office and the whole operation. So somebody comes to a V show and they're in line, you know, and we know they're seeing that show. And it's almost like the, you know, would you like fries and a Coke with that? It's, hey, now that you're seeing this show, you know what's also great? We'd love for you to come back, you know, tonight and see Mark Savard at Comedy Hypnosis. So we cross-promote the shows, and it just kind of, you know, one and one equals three at that point. It's just, it's interesting, you know. There's synergy there with all the shows. And that fear of a show coming in there for the first time, you know, of saying, oh, man, this is too many shows, or we're not gonna be enough customers to divide. They instantly realize and get it, like, oh, this is great. There's a ton of crowd everywhere. We have 25,000 people a week going through there that never heard of Miracle Mile Shops or Planet Hollywood. And, you know, we bring them in from our marketing and such, and then we get them back to come see a second show too.
I did a little story not too long ago about the Miracle Mile Shops and how the mall has been open since June, where Planet Hollywood is only now this week going to reopen after being closed since March. And a lot of people didn't realize that the mall was still open. Your theaters, of course, have been closed since March as well. But I don't think people realize how big of a driver the mall is for that resort, and also how big of a driver the theaters are for the mall and for the resort.
I was called in when it was, Robert Earl, when he owned Planet Hollywood. Mm-hmm. I was called in. The president of Planet Hollywood wanted to talk to me about something. So I go, oh, shoot. And they have nothing to do with us, you know, but I'm like, what the hell? What the heck's the problem? You know, so I go there and I meet with them, and they said, hey, we just conducted a survey of Planet Hollywood. We have this company, they do a whole survey, and they said, guess what the number one question is of all people at Planet Hollywood, all the customers of Planet Hollywood? So, where's the bathroom? He says, close. He goes, but where's the V theater? It was the number one question. And I said, you're welcome. It's so big. There's so many people coming there, and, you know, they'll go through the casino, then they'll go through the mall. I talked to the stores in the mall, and they're like, oh my God, you guys give us so much business. We just, everybody who comes in, they're like, they just saw a show. And the, you know, we do dinner packages too. We send thousands of people to the restaurants to do dinner show combos. And so I've never really touted that or anything to the mall or any of them. But during this whole pandemic, I had time to reflect, and I'm just thinking, wow, we are like, the tail that wags that dog, man, we really bring a lot of people there, and they got to be dying because we're closed. And yeah, that's what I got. I got a lot of the store owners calling me going, please open. Just, there's just nobody here, and we need you back. And you know, we're technically and legally not allowed to yet. So I think it'll be huge for the mall when we get to be fully up and running without the limitations.
Of course, those limitations, the rules and the protocols for shows really, in addition to other group gatherings, changed last week. The governor announced that restrictions were loosened up a little bit, and now the number of people you can have in a space for different kinds of events in Las Vegas has gone up. And of course, there's extra little rules surrounding what kind of business it is. But essentially, the doors have opened for some shows to get back in action. What is your strategy right now for relaunching some of your shows in either of those spaces at this point?
Well, first and foremost was the safety and clarity on, as a venue owner, what do we have to do to get open? You know, they put the 25-foot rule from the stage, the first audience members, and then we have to test, check their temperature when they come in. We have to ask them questions about sort of contact tracing. Have you been in contact with anybody? So there's a lot of things they just put on us, and I'm trying to make sure we can deliver all of that the right way and hopefully not get sued. You know, just asking somebody if they got, they have COVID in itself is a HIPAA violation, I would imagine. If you ask your employees, hey, do you have a disease or do you have a virus, in itself, it could be problematic, you know? So we're trying to get clarification just to reconfirm that exactly what we have to do and how we have to do it. Phase two of that is, okay, we've got that figured out now. Is this even commercially viable? Can we even make enough money just to pay the dang insurance bill, you know? And at this moment, no, it's not enough. The limitations are so bad. We just call it the V Theater, but there's three theaters inside there, V1, 2, and 3. Right. And V2, which houses The Mentalist and All Shook Up, Las Vegas Comedy Live, those, I can't even open that room at all because it's only 25 feet deep, the whole room, you know? It affects from the stage. So I can't even open that. V1, the big room there, is 400 seats. So you would think we could get 200, you know, 50% capacity, but nope. 25 feet back plus the social distancing measures and all that is maybe 50 people. And then that's if we can even open, because the first 25 feet is where we have handicap seating. So that eliminates all handicap seating. Can I open without any handicap seating? I doubt it. And to build handicap seating in the risers, that'll take time and a lot of money to redo the whole theater. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of clarifications we need from the building department and health department, and you know, just arbitrarily saying, hey, set back 25 feet. Well, now that changes ingress and egress. Just a lot of things are altered. If somebody wants to come in and out of the building, the customers want to go to the bathroom, where they walk gets affected now too, because that 25 feet, it just dramatically affects everything. So I don't even think technically we can still open most of the venues based on that limitation alone.
Your larger spaces, the room you just described at V Theater, and then the space at Saks Theater, those are very traditional theater spaces. They're not like rooms that are easily adjustable. You know, you can't just pull the road seating out and put cabaret tables in there. They're built to be a certain kind of theater. So to adjust that drastically to get a more feasible capacity in there is not a practical solution.
Yeah. And then even if we can't open and all of that is met and there's no code violations and everything's fine, you know, the distancing measures, you know, parties of two. 60% of our patrons are coming parties of two. So then I have to have three seats between them to make sure we have six feet of separation. And then every other row, provided that's 6 feet, unless we have to go two rows, I believe every other row is fine. And once you seat them in the way they come, you know, parties of four, the next biggest is about 20% are parties of four, then parties of three, then parties of five, then parties of one. You know, to distance them based on the averages of how of these seating stats or the party stats, I've got this whole model we just keep doing to populate the room and keep trying it over and over and over. And you still can't even get, we're in 15% bill. So public thinks, what's the big deal? Go to 50% capacity. It's not too bad. I'm at 15% capacity. That's bad. So right now I can't open. And then the whole challenges of opening the venue, put my theater hat on for a sec, but we have to rehire and retrain everybody. Every usher, box office person, just all the people. I mean, a lot of people are gone now. They've moved back home or, you know, their lives have gone elsewhere. So we have to retrain everybody. And then the put the show hat on, same thing. It's even worse. You know, Vegas, the show, I already know several of the showgirls and the dancers. They're married now. They have kids. But a lot's happened in these months. Some have moved away, so it's recasting and redoing the shows from scratch. Everything, it's, you know, getting that giant train going again is, it's just very difficult. So, but I'm still doing it and I'm still trying.
You've been through this whole shutdown time, you know, you've been staying on top of the various developments and trying to figure out, you know, educating yourself about the safety protocols and about the virus, I'm sure, and, you know, trying to make plans, and then things change, and then you kind of wipe everything off and start all over again. I would assume you've been kind of frozen in this wait-and-see situation. I'm sure you haven't really had the chance to, you know, plan B it in some effect, like really figure out a new way to operate your theaters, or maybe to even have to create different kinds of entertainment around this thing. Like, you really haven't had any chance to escape this thing and work your way around it, I would think.
Well, I remind myself every day, this is also a gift to have time. You know, I used to always want the world to stop so I can catch up with my work. And so what a gift, you know, the world did stop. Now make sure you work your ass off and you come out of this other side better. And so I wrote two new shows. I revised Zombie Burlesque and Vegas the Show. I ready to put in the stuff that I always wanted to get in but never got it in from the opening. But once the show's open, it's hard to get changes made, you know. It's a weird thing. But so I wrote and I came up with new policies and procedures for all our company, every department, whether it's accounting or whatever. I've been taking advantage of this time and ready for this, thinking by the time we open, I could just implement all this new stuff and we'll be good. But I didn't imagine a 25-foot setback and all these other measures that were just thrown together. And I didn't imagine originally that the governor would just say, oh, in a day and a half you can open. Oh, thanks for the heads up and plenty of notice, you know. It doesn't take us any time. So you just think, you know, they would say, hey, in 2 months on this date, all of you can open, unless something drastic happens and COVID gets worse, then I'll push you back. But at least give us a somewhat of a heads up. You know, you did the same thing with the restaurant industry, and, you know, that's bad as well. You have to order food and can't just open. But so that's very frustrating as a business owner, the lack of details that whoever's making these decisions to which businesses can be open or not and how they can operate. It's crazy how they got it wrong, in my opinion.
Well, I have to say, as a writer and as someone who attempts to be creative from time to time, that's pretty impressive that you've been able to maintain your creativity and write some new material and make those kinds of plans during this very challenging time.
Yeah, I mean, I've written things I've always had on my mind but never had the time to write. And I know, I believe entertainment style is changing, you know, and it's less traditional shows and different stuff. So I developed all the stuff I've had in my mind for a long time, and I can't wait to do it, but it's very, very scary to know that tourism's down, obviously, but still, you know, when they opened business up, but still nobody, not that many people came, and it's not exactly a show crowd coming back, and it's just scary for my industry and what I do, that when this whole thing, when the dust settles on this, I think the whole entertainment scene has changed and different, and what people want to do and don't want to do. And, you know, yesterday or today, they just announced that movie theaters, they're going to close the movie theaters. I guess there's no content. That's a different reason. But yeah, I'm just worried now that, okay, so what if we get through all these challenges and we get the theaters open and all the shows open and all that? And is anybody going to come? I don't know if anybody's going to come to Vegas or to shows. Extremely challenging on so many levels, but I think just like most people in entertainment, we can't not try to get a show open or put a show together. It's just in our blood, and we have to keep going on, and the show must go on. It's just nothing we're patting ourselves on the back about, saying like, oh boy, we sure have a great attitude. We just can't shake it. That's just who we are. We just want to put a show on. We can't wait. Even if there's no audience or you know, with all these challenges. So I just can't stop wanting to keep putting more shows together and more stuff out there.
This really is what you do. This is what the Vegas entertainment community does. You guys have all been making things happen under difficult circumstances and coming up with creative and innovative ways to do what you do and entertain people for your whole careers, for you, your whole life you've been doing this. So when we get clear what the rules are and when we can get some people back to Vegas, that's the one thing that there's a lot of confidence about, is that you and your colleagues will be bringing the show like you did before, maybe better than you did before.
Definitely improved and better. This time off makes you realize how lucky we were to be able to do what we do and put shows on, and just don't want to take advantage of that ever again. And just want to make sure when we get back up and again, man, it's just standing ovation or nothing. Just keep rewriting. All right, I'm going to tweak that again. That didn't work. All right, I'm going to tweak that again. I just can't wait for that. That excites me. That brings me back to when I was 16 in the showroom and writing something that got a standing ovation and thinking that was the coolest thing ever. It's just so fun to something come from your brain to a napkin to somebody talking about it. You go to lunch and you hear another table talking about something you created and how they love it, and it's the coolest feeling. So can't wait for that.
That's going to do it for this episode of The Sun on the Strip. Thanks for listening. Many thanks to David Sachs for joining me today. I've been following his shows and his career for a long time. Finally got the chance to talk to him, and happy to be able to bring that conversation to you. I hope you enjoyed it. You can listen to past episodes of The Sun on the Strip by going to lasvegassun.com/podcasts, and you could listen and subscribe at Apple Podcasts. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you right here next week.